Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by World's Best Cheese. For more information, visit wbcheese.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to Cutting the Curd. This is your host, Greg Blaze, and in the studio I have Cutting the Curd founder and overlord Ann Sachs will be with me. How are you today, Ann?
Hello. I'm doing very well. Thank you.
It's always good to see you. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about succession planning with regards to artisan, privately owned dairies. Like any small business, cheesemakers who own their own creameries must plan for their eventual retirement. Many times what's at stake choosing a successor or just deciding to close down your doors isn't just economic stability for the retiring cheesemaker, but preserving unique products that have made an impact in the cheesemaker's local food system and perhaps even the American food culture as a whole. On today's show, we have two Farmstead cheesemakers on the line who are also owners of their operations. Lainey of Lazy Lady Farms in Westfield, Vermont. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yep.
And also we have the estimable Andy Hatch on the line, owner and cheesemaker of the Uplands Cheese Company in Doddsville, Wisconsin. Thanks for joining us on the show today, Andy.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Greg.
Always, man. We tried to get you on our little drunken holiday special, but you were probably too busy like making Rush Creek or something like that.
My mom listens to your show. I just couldn't bring myself to do it.
Nice.
So our goal was to talk about this difficult question of succession planning because it's, you know, it sounds easy. It's just a word, succession planning, but it's actually really a difficult thing. And so we wanted to get kind of two perspectives. So I guess, Lainey, if you could start by telling us a little bit about your operation. When did you start making cheese at Lazy Lady and how has your business kind of evolved over the years? Let's start with that, and then we'll get to the future part.
started with zero, nothing minus. barren land, little cabin, no electricity, vegetables, and some sheep and a goat. And just, you know, knowing I wanted to get into cheese, but just trying to claw my way into having enough money to build the place, build the barn, build a facility, build a herd. So spent a lot of time just trying to build infrastructure with what money I could earn because we didn't have any means for borrowing money. So then working from that to now a small plant that produces about 300 gallons of milk, runs about 300 gallons of milk per week through the building, about 250 to 350 pounds of cheese per week in small formats, the 3 and 4 ounce pieces, milking 40 goats. Wintertime, purchasing about 200 gallons of milk from neighboring dairy farms, a Jersey herd, and I have a couple recipes that I like, Holstein milk, and one full-time employee and three part-time employees, plus then Barry and I work time and a half.
Yeah, so that's, and when you started, it was in the early 80s, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, so I feel like, yeah, you were definitely one of the pioneers of cheese making in this country in general, let alone trying to tackle making these fussy, small format Bloomy Rind cheeses for which there was no precedent. So given that you're such a self-starter and, you know, you've bootstrapped your way to where you are and you've just, like, you know, earned everything you've got, how do you think about succession planning? Is that something that's interesting to you, to think about someone else running your business at some point? Or for you, is it so personal?
I would like that, but, you know, whether they'd want to do it this way or not, you know, off the grid and small. I don't know. That's my, you know, I think about that. You know, everybody's so big. I don't know if there's going to be somebody who wants to do it this size.
Well, so I don't know. I feel like, well, I guess it's an interesting thing because your actual, you know, your home is actually kind of tied up with, you know, it's your land, it's
yes.
your house, it's blah, blah,
yep.
blah. So,
right.
And I guess over the years, I mean, you have had help over the years. Have you ever had an employee who you thought like, oh, hey, this might be like an interesting person. This, you know, we really click, you know, this could work. Or have you had someone come to work for you as an apprentice?
I've had him, but it would really take two people, and I haven't had a team, you know, or I haven't bumped into that person yet. I've had good help, you know.
How many hours a week just on it do you really estimate that you put in? Like, it's
me?
Yeah.
In full season, 98.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Yep.
And so you got to find one person. I think that's
right.
That's the thing. It's yours. And you
yes.
do it because it's yours. You own. You take ownership over all the products, over all the animals,
yep.
and your land. So,
yep.
I mean, how does it perpetuate itself? You know what I mean? Like, you got to...
Right. Because the people who work here, the full-time person, well, one can only work 40 hours a week, or I get into overtime, and most of the time they don't want to work more than 40 hours a week.
Yeah. Normal people want to work normal hours. We you know, that's, you know,
we entrepreneurs
I mean?
Are special.
You know? So Andy, you know, so some of our listeners know your wife and the Marika family purchased, you and your wife and the Marika family purchased Uplands Cheese from the company's founders. In that case, their succession plan was to sell to a new generation of cheesemaker, you, and that worked out pretty well for them. We're all still enjoying Pleasant Ridge Reserve. It's a beloved American cheese. How did that work out well for you? You know what I mean? Like, what was the process that you guys went through that that made it so you could purchase the farm?
Yeah, well, it was a long process. It took years, and at times it was agonizingly slow. You know, I'm 35 now, and I probably told them I wanted to buy it when I was, I don't know, 27.
Oh my God.
You know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, I didn't have any money, and an operation like ours isn't big, but you start adding up the numbers. You know, you've got 300 acres, you got about $1 million in dirt, you've got a couple of hundred cows, you got $500,000 in cows, you've got your inventory, your cheese making equipment. You know, you get into those seven figures really quickly. And so, you know, a bank wants to see 20% down. I couldn't come close to that. But anyway, it was a bit of a non-starter at first. And that was agonizing because as it became clear that they needed to they were looking to find a buyer, all the other cheese companies came to sort of kick the tires. And it was interesting to see that an operation like ours didn't really fit neatly into the business models of larger companies. You know, we're not really scalable. If you're going to continue to just use, pasture-fed milk from our own herd, you've got X number of acres, supports X number of cows, and the grazing season is X number of days long, and there's your 10,000 wheels of Pleasant Ridge a year, and that's it. So, you know, those companies all came in and thought, wow, you know, we'll buy this business, we'll quadruple production, and we'll resell it for, you know, four times what we paid for it or whatever. But it wasn't the case here. And so after years of that, Mike, you know, realized that I was, the best option because I was, could do it and wanted to do it. So, I think there are a couple of points you could, to make there. One is, access to capital is hard for young people, and even the small cheese making businesses are capital intensive. You know, the equipment and the land and the animals are expensive. The second point to make is that to teach somebody how to run these businesses, seasonal cheese making, animals, handling the variability of raw milk, it takes years. And so while it was really agonizing for me to want to do it so badly and not be able to make the deal happen right away, that it took a long time was really good. It was a long, slow transition. You've got to see a lot of seasons to really understand how a farm behaves. And you know, I think those are two important issues with these smaller, quirky businesses that you know, independent operators are attracted to, but they don't always lend themselves to.
They're not linear.
Transition.
Yeah, they're not linear. Hard to quantify.
Well, and it's interesting to me in listening to you talk that Mike, you know, was so true to his vision that he wasn't willing to kind of sell to somebody who would compromise the integrity of the cheese. You know, that he was. I find that really awesome and cool and very unusual. You know, that somebody would say, okay, well, this is the cheese. This is the season. This is how it's done. And so I imagine, just by hearing you tell the story, that factor was a big part of the story, that Mike wasn't willing to sell the business to somebody who was going to kind of change the way the cheese was produced.
That's right. And I think I give some of these bigger cheese companies credit that also that they realized if they were to come in and change the nature of what we do here, the cheese would change and the market would figure it out, and it wouldn't stay the same. I don't know. I mean, you see other big companies make those kind of moves all the time. You dilute the quality of the product, and it takes a couple of years, but everybody figures it out. And so I think that I was surprised that a big company didn't take the chance here. But Mike was committed to the way he wanted to do it, and it. In the end, it was my luck.
Well, it's all our luck because you make awesome cheese, and we don't want that to change. And so it seems to me like, you know, when you decide on a succession plan, there's four options. You can sell to another cheesemaker looking for an established business, which is what Uplands did with you. I can go in that old traditional European model, I guess, which is kind of dying out in Europe as I've seen it or I've been told by the cheesemakers I buy from there, where you can give the farm over to your kids or your other family. You can sell to a larger corporation, which people have done. I just was hoping to get in another show because we're trying to do a series on this to get Jennifer Bice to come and talk to us too. Mm. She sold her.
That's a
dairy.
Good yeah. model there. Yep.
You know, you can go to Emmy, or you can close shop. You know, I mean, there's obvious benefits and drawbacks to each. You know, but I mean, so Lainey what do you?
I don't
think?
Want to close shop.
Right. So what's your ideal situation? What's the ideal situation for you?
I guess I would like for, you know, if I have to put, you know, at some point maybe put, you know, put it up for sale like you know, through the owner, not a realtor, and, you know, either owner, you know, even owner finance, that kind of thing. Not that they have to go through a bank. I'd be willing to do the owner financing.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, can you even generalize it? I mean, is that too general for me to say it that way? You know, I think that's really it. Those are your options, right?
Yes, yes. I don't have a lot of options. I don't want to just sell it, you know, pack up everything and then sell it as a bare farm. Just, I mean, the animals there, you know, I put so much effort into the breeding stock that would be a shame. Mm. And then, you know, a lot of. Customers, clients, retailers, distributors, all set up.
Oh, yeah. Well, and what would you think about, Lainey, would you ever consider some sort of like hybridized model whereby, you know, you could like retain control of the goats and someone else would make the cheese or vice versa?
Yep. Yep. That too.
Yeah. 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 It's, I don't know. It's interesting. So it's a kind of about identifying, I guess, it's funny. I think about it like in Europe, like Greg was saying, it seems like the wheels are better greased for all these transitions in some ways. And maybe these things are dying out, but either between families handing businesses down to younger generations or through a kind of more established apprenticeship model, it seems like transitions of these kinds of agricultural businesses you know, happen that way over there because there's this long, slow transition, like Andy was talking about. But here, it's I feel like it's not quite there yet. And so the question is, how would you identify? You know, I guess Andy, can you talk a little bit about how you met Mike and how you got involved with Uplands, because that's really like happenstance, but like what an amazing yeah. connection.
I guess the end of the story ended in luck. It started in kind of a lucky way too. I was a student coming out of the University of Wisconsin's dairy science program, and I was getting my cheesemaking license. So I'd worked for cheesemakers in Western Europe for a couple of years at that point, and I'd worked for a couple other cheesemakers in Wisconsin. But I was nearing the end of my sort of apprenticeship requirements. You have to have a cheesemaking license in Wisconsin, and to get a license, you've got to serve apprenticeships and take classes and then take a test. And so this was the last apprenticeship I did. I started here in 2007, and I had asked Mike for a job earlier, 2004, 2005. And at that point, he was still making all the cheese. We're such a small shop that, you know, there really isn't room for an excess apprentice. But by 2007, you know, physically, he needed some help, so he called me, and I came out here. And like I said, from there, it was long and gradual. You know, year after year, I just sort of gradually took on a little bit more and more responsibility, and in a lot of ways, Mike's a father figure to me. I learned a lot from him, and that kind of long, slow transition is probably similar to what happens between some fathers and sons. Though, of course, you can't idealize that either.
Businesses
are controlled for so long by one person and all of their idiosyncrasies. You know. Trying to give up control, even to a son, can be really awkward. You know, you see it with so many neighboring farm families. At some point, dad's got to stop making decisions, and the son gets to make the decisions. But it's not easy. And Mike deserves a lot of credit for, stepping away his ego. Demand control of the situation longer than was natural, you could say.
And because of that, you'll be better equipped to know how to pass that on. And if you want to do that either within your own family or to somebody else, because you're a person that actually got to go through that long process. I mean, you know, the cheese making at a farmstead level is hard. You know, you're overseeing the management of the land, the animals, and the cheese from the making to the aging and sometimes the distribution. So, I mean, is there really even time to think about succession planning? You know what I mean? Or are you just, you know what I mean? Like, are you just doing it? And also, like, if you don't have that sort of connection that you were lucky enough to get, I mean, what resources are there out there for small farmstead and artisan cheesemakers to, like, plan for retirement?
Well, there aren't many resources for cheesemakers. There are quite a few for farmers.
Yes.
You know, Wisconsin runs a program through, you know, the University Extension, connecting retiring farmers to aspiring farmers.
That's good.
There's just a grazing apprenticeship program that started in Wisconsin. It's going national now, you know, connecting people with grass-based dairy farms, with apprentices. It's a huge issue. Most, you know, dairy states, most farming states are talking about this, how to make these transitions. But not a lot of people, except, you know, Ann and Greg, are talking about it for the small cheese companies.
Now, Lainey, what about Vermont? Because I know Vermont does a lot for its farmers as well.
Right. They said they work with the dairy folks, but there has been nothing, and they should be, because there's quite a few of us now in the cheesemaking world, you know, at least a dozen of us, the original starters, are in that 60-year-old range. So it's coming up.
now let me ask one more.
Coming soon.
Yeah.
I love it.
So funny. Now let me ask this. Is this something that you think the Vermont Cheese Council could get involved with?
No, it's something. No, it's very good food for thought. Yes. No, this is a, you know, yes, I would certainly think it's getting time that, we kind of like delve into this. I'm open, you know, for any idea. I said my battle is the smallness of the place, keeping someone out of debt, you know, too much debt, so they can, carry on, because what this place makes doesn't allow for too much debt. Or I said it's a it'd be a team that would take it over,
and you know, tackle a lot of the work themselves, and then bring on help later on. You know, to stay away from payroll for a while. That's my biggest expense is the payroll.
Sure, humans cost money. They really do.
Yeah, you know, you got to pay them well. You know, they get way better than us.
Yeah,
and so that's probably close to 40% of my bills.
Wow, and it's about that much of mine too. So we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come right back and discuss the secession plans with Lainey and Andy. Just hold on with us for a minute.
Yep.
Help me find a way outside, away from all the madness. Keeping everybody on the toes now, making it so hard to keep my balance. Balancing between the people.
Today's program was brought to you by World's Best Cheese. The World's Best Cheeses offers a world-class selection of specialty foods, from fine artisanal domestic products to unique gourmet items from France, UK, Italy, Spain, Germany, Switzerland, Portugal, Denmark, Holland, Norway, and Canada. They offer over 2,500 delicious products, including world-class cheeses, crackers, dips, and spreads. They pride themselves on their commitment to service and their ability to find the products your customers want at great prices. For more information, visit wbcheese.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Cutting the Curd. This is Greg Blaze in the Heritage Radio Network studios with my co-host, Ann Saxelby. On the line, we're so honored to have two amazing farmstead cheesemakers, Lainey of Lazy Lady Farm in Vermont and Andy of Uplands Cheese in Wisconsin. So before the break, we were talking about some of the technical aspects of succession planning for smaller, privately owned farms and cheesemaking operations. For the next part of the show, we wanted to talk a little bit more about the cultural implications of succession. On last week's episode, I talked to Matt Rubiner about current events in cheese, and one recurring theme that we kept touching on was that we're in a sort of golden age of artisan cheese right now. Sure, you know, the regulatory environment might not be exactly what we want it to be, but more people are making cheese and more people are eating cheese and learning about it. So my first question is for Andy, you know, do you think it's important for certain cheeses to be multi-generational and to outlive the people who created those recipes?
For the landscape of American artisan cheese, absolutely, and that's a really important question that doesn't get talked about all that often. And you know, the question is, to what extent are the life expectancies of these cheeses wrapped up in the life expectancy of the cheesemaker, him or herself? And you know, if you look as a model at you know, some of the great old world wines. You know, who is the winemaker at DRC right now? I have no idea, but you know, it's a fantastic wine. It has been, and you got to assume it always will be. And you know, what I think has happened in the States, you know, along with the rest of the trend in the culinary world, has been to try to make the cheesemaker the star. They do it with chefs, and that is intoxicating probably for some cheesemakers, and it may work as a marketing tool, but it really causes problems then when you need to, when that person has to step away. And I again, was lucky here in that you know, that was, I think, never the case with Mike, and I try to make it the same way, that the cheese should be the focus, not the person making it. And But obviously, that's not always the case, and I wonder how much that's just a cultural, you know, and a way of, that Americans approach food these days. They want to know all about the person who makes it, instead of just concentrating on the product itself.
Lainey, what do you think about that?
I can barely hear what he was saying. In your question regarding, if I understand it correctly, the continuation of the cheese that is
Absolutely.
Made on all these. Cheese farmstead cheese operations.
Yes.
Is that the question?
Yes.
I guess my thought, I have pondered that thought, and I guess what I've thought, I wouldn't want to kind of shackle them into, oh, these are the cheeses you're going to make, you know, my you know, because I make 15 or so, you know, but
as a business one that they could just slide and, you know, not have difficulties in getting cheeses out there, you know, stay with the plan here. Stay with these cheeses. These cheeses sell, and as they got, you know, the person got better and better, developed their own. But, you know, and so, you know, stay with most of them. Then if they wanted to wean off a few of them and develop their own, go that way. I don't have, you know, I'm attached to them. But
they're like an expression of your farm,
their operation,
too.
If, you know, what if they change? You know, was this talk about the name change? What if they didn't want to be called, you know, Lazy Lady Farm? That's another thing. You know, I have a name, and Andy, I, you know, kept the Upland name. So there's the name, and there's the cheese. There's two things.
And you name the cheeses so well. I mean, who else could come up with some of these great names?
But,
I mean, come on.
But would you want to shackle someone into all of that? That's my thought.
Well, and it's an interesting question because I feel like, again, like if you're talking Europe versus America, I feel like in Europe it's the opposite. It's like you go to school, if you want to be a cheesemaker, I feel like you go to school and oftentimes, especially with AOC cheeses, you know, then you learn to make a cheese. And it's not about you, it's about the cheese.
Right.
But so it's very interesting, I feel like, kind of free-spirited, like, you know, in super American dialogue that we're having about like, oh, well, does someone want to continue to make my cheese or... Like Andy was saying, like where does it stop with like the personality of the cheesemaker and the kind and the cheese that's well known at this point? Like Lazy Lady Farm is a name. You know, if someone changed the name, it would be like the Beatles changing their name. You know, it'd be like everyone would be like, who's that? You know,
right?
So it seems like it would behoove somebody who wanted to get into this, you know, succession of a cheese business to kind of keep a lot of things the same, keep it true.
I would like that, but. That, I don't know, you know, would I find that person, you know, committed to doing that and realizing, well, you know, I'm stepping into something that can just easily slide into the stores, you know?
Yeah.
And not have a struggle. You just pick up a phone and you call Ann and you call Provisions and, you know, and off it goes. You know, because it's it. The other thing is, like you're saying, there are a lot of cheeses out there. There are a lot of cheesemakers. So to not to be the new kid on the block, you know, my advice would be to stay the course. But I don't know what, you know, personalities anybody's going
to
have.
But see, that I'd like to speak to what Andy said, and that's the point and the issue is are we about us or are we about the stuff that we make? You know, because. I agree. Our food culture in general in this country has definitely shifted to who, you know, who's in the vat or who's behind the line, you know, and people pay a lot of attention to that. I think that they do that in cheese a lot. I think that we do that with cheesemongers and cheesemongery as well.
Well, and just small business in general, you know, it's like I can speak to that as a small business owner, like my name's on the business, you know, and if I'm not at the store behind the counter, some people are fine with whoever else is behind the counter and some people are not. And it's a difficult thing, in whatever kind of business you're running, for sure.
Right. But
so then, Anne, I would turn the tables on you. So what about your business? I mean, what are you going to do? What's Saxelby Cheesemongers going to be? Is it always going to be like that? Yeah, no? What's going to go on there?
Well, so I guess, so right now my two kids have Patrick's last name. They're both Martins's.
Will it be called like Smartlebys? Smaxelbils?
So first, we'll have to change one of their last name to Saxelby.
Yep.
I don't know how Patrick will feel about that. No, but I mean, I think it would be awesome if one of my kids decides to be interested in cheese and wanted to continue the business. It seems like for the majority of other, you know, people that I've spoken to that have a small business or have a cheese making operation, that's usually not how it goes. Usually the kids are interested in their own thing.
Yeah.
Which I totally respect. But, I mean, yes, I would like Saxelby Cheesemongers to endure and to keep supporting American artisan cheese after I, you know, bite the dust, and that would be great. So yeah, I haven't started on it yet, but But
Get thinking.
I know.
You better
know.
Start thinking about
it. Hey, Ian, while you're answering questions, can I ask another question?
Of course.
This is for you too, Greg. I mean, how does it look as cheesemongers? I mean, you guys worry that you're addicted to things that are new? You know, there's been so many new cheeses.
There's a lot.
American cheeses coming out. What is the value on a cheese counter of keeping these 15, 20, 30-year-old cheeses around?
Yeah.
Well,
assuming they're going to be replaced by equally good or better cheeses, you know, is there some cultural value in having the multi-generational production of the same product? Or as Americans, should we just be celebrating the fact that we're going to, like, constant, you know, creative destruction and just turn over the whole cheese industry every generation?
No, well, I think it's interesting. To me, I feel like there's definitely value in innovation. Like Lainey was saying, would someone want to be shackled to her cheese or invent some new stuff? And I feel like that has been a real strength of American artisan cheese making, that there is no, there's not even a mold to break. You know, it's just like there are certainly established precedents, but I think that people are really creative and they're coming up with like beautiful new cheeses all the time. That said, for me, the bottom line is quality, you know, and it's like, if a cheese is delicious and if a cheese, you know, when you line it up with 5 other, 10 other cheeses on a counter, however many, you know, and you're tasting it and it's great, like Lainey's cheeses or like Andy, the Pleasant Ridge or Rush Creek, then for me, that's what endures. And I think that it would be a shame to keep reinventing and lose those that are so special. Sure, I think as it will go, I'm sure some cheeses will fall by the wayside. Unfortunately, like, you know, Greg and I both used to sell Sally Jackson cheeses back in the day. Those were amazing.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And those aren't made anymore. And I feel like that's, you know, that's a disservice to the American artisan cheese industry.
But you look at the reasons why things like that happen. And I think that it's why did that cheese go away? What did we not do as an industry to support that operation to make sure
she had a bad incident?
Yeah, but
she had a bad incident, and she was kind of a one woman operation. And you know, I feel like when you couple those two things, it's very difficult.
Yes, and so she threw up her hands.
I know for a fact. I bought that cheese for a long time, and I bought it when it was amazing, and I bought it when it was not so amazing. You know, and I wonder a lot if I contributed to things like that because I was not prepared to offer feedback. You know, because I think that that what your question originally to Ann and I, Andy, is like the answer is quality. Quality determines what sticks around and what does not. I mean, I have 300 cheeses up on the counter sometimes at once. I don't care so much what is new. I can't just keep adding things and adding things and adding things. But what sticks around, and how my job as a cheesemonger is to give the feedback to make sure that those things stick around by giving honest feedback about the quality of them. Or I guess that's my answer. I also don't believe in innovation for innovation's sake. I like things that are classical and endure because I think that's what cheese is all about.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
So here comes a new cheesemaker, and here comes a cheese. So, you know, you got your pile of cheese. You got your 300 cheeses. Here comes somebody new, really delicious. Then you've got a lot of work to do to introduce it to your customers.
A lot, yeah.
A lot.
Well, there's a lot of work to do in order to I've worked through the transition. I've worked through the succession as a cheesemonger. Like I say, with a place like Uplands, it was seamless. I never felt like I was eating a different cheese, which is great. For new cheesemakers, there's a lot. I mean, so I'm at the end of the line. I work with Ann. Ann will bring me some cheese and say, "Try this out." We put it up on the counter. We taste. When we send the feedback up the chain, you know.
Yeah,
but it does. It's a lot of time.
It's a lot of work.
And it's funny for me as like a cheese, you know, having a small shop and a small distribution business, like. You know, and it's just, we're a 5-person team, you know, it is so much work, introducing a new cheese. So now we really think about it. I feel like, you know, maybe back in the day, maybe, you know, 5-6 years ago, we were just kind of like, oh yeah, let's try it. Let's see how it goes. But now it's like, it's a big commitment. If we bring in a new cheese, you know, it's really gotta, it's, and the other thing that we didn't really touch on before is that yes, quality is paramount. But also, you know, if it's a new cheese, is it different? I feel like we also see, you know, a lot of people making very similar cheeses, and I see cheesemakers making more varieties of cheese. And Lainey, you've always done that, so I feel like that's been your calling card since the beginning. But you know, for example, I feel like some cheesemakers want to diversify, whether it's because they sell at farmers markets or just because they feel like they want to sell more cheese, and so they make more kinds. But I feel like that's not always the best way. I feel like, Lainey, for your business, it works particularly well because they're all small format. They all are related in some way. But yeah, it's funny. Andy's at the opposite end of the spectrum, only making one. And I feel like people should err on the side more of just like making one, two, three, maybe max, that are great and not making six or 10. I mean,
for the nature of our discussion, it seems to me that it would be a lot easier, and maybe I guess both of them have their own set of quandaries, but it'd be easier to turn over an operation to someone new that only had to make two cheeses.
Correcto
as opposed
mundo.
To someone had to make 15 kinds of cheese, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so you have to have ADHD and be into it.
Nice.
So there you go. We just wrote the job description. Must have ADHD and love working 98 hours a week. I'm sure.
Awesome.
You know, I have one more point to make. It popped into my head when you're talking about and you know the difficulty of introducing a new cheese, and to me the other side of that coin is what's the value of an existing cheese. And so if people listen to this program who are interested in selling or in buying an existing operation, that question has got to get answered at some point. What is the value of the label or, you know, of the ongoing operation? And having gone through it myself, I just want to, you know, say to everybody, I don't know.
And
I talked to everybody I could talk to. There is not really an industry standard that I'm aware of for valuing these small cheesemaking operations.
Well, you're
so,
setting.
You know, like in the restaurant industry, you go to some midtown Manhattan restaurant, 200-seater, anybody in the industry could tell you it's worth, you know, five times its revenue or, you know, whatever. There's sort of a multiplier. But, you know, it's a very difficult thing to pin down with these small, idiosyncratic, niche-y cheesemaking businesses.
You just got a ton of variables. And then you have legislation like slowly marching toward you. You know, I mean,
how do you quantify that risk?
You're gonna buy something. Your whole operation's based on making raw milk cheese, and then all of a sudden, you know, the goalposts get moved, and you can't make what your whole operation's set up to make anymore.
I mean, God, what kind of fool would do something like that?
Not you. Amazing.
Walk right into it.
You're a crazy man. That's great. Well, I wanted to say just thanks so much to Lainey and Andy for coming on the show.
That was fun. Yep, and, food for thought.
And Anne, thanks always for coming in. And,
thank you for being the steward of Cutting the Curd. You're the best.
So tune in next week for another great episode with Diane Stemple featuring some of our favorite cheese artists. Thanks for listening. Stay cheesy.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to This Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.